We're back, Gabbing with Invincible, episode four. I'm Gab.
I'm
And
Vince. I'm the dad. Rarely called invincible.
yeah, right.
Gabby calls me a fascia. Wherever she got that one from, I don't know. But
Austin Powers.
oh, that's what it is. Of course.
Fasha, can you hear me? Fasha.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be cool. We
Yeah.
got the guy who created the movie. I mean, he's the one that took the risk, and of course his name is Ken Mock, and you've known him forever, and he came up with a couple of the shows that you like so much, and especially one that is maybe go worldwide right now.
Yeah, America's Next Top Model, Making the Band, if anybody remembers Danity Kane. He's basically the pioneer of unscripted TV, like now television producer and now director. So he's got some really, really cool stories, really, really cool background, and we're really excited to have him.
Yeah, pretty exciting. He's got a great new project coming up, and it's called Ginormal, and it's pretty crazy with all influencers. It's a sci-fi. We'll let him talk about it, but we'll be having Ken Mock coming up in just a sec.
Alrighty, so we are here with the one and only Ken Mock. Ken has an unbelievable story. He went from a news producer and with CNN to executive producer of movies, now director. He's a father, he's a husband. And we are so excited to have him here. Ken, welcome to Gabbing with Invincible.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's so great. It was a pleasure to be with you. I guess we have to sort of tell everybody that we were with each other this past weekend up in is it Brentwood? Is that
Yeah,
the
and Brentwood.
right. If you don't know Brentwood, it's UCLA. Anybody that's I'm in Philly right now. Gabby's in Jupiter, Florida. So we're saying we're just triangulating here. But yeah, we had a great weekend, and you just I said, Gab, we got to get candle. I mean, this is going to be a lot of fun. So where do you want to start, Gab? I'll let you get it going here, shoot the
I mean, I
gun.
think maybe let's start off with your background in entertainment and TV. And so, I know you started off CNN, you were a news producer. So, and then you eventually made your way into movies, which is a huge turn and so different. So, let's talk about where that started, how that started for you, and what led you to where you are right now as a director.
From the East Coast, I'm from New York. I'm born and raised there. Went to Boston University and studied journalism and actually business there. And I always wanted to get into the entertainment business, but I didn't really know how. So I really the first step I took was I went into the news business. So I actually when I was in Boston, I worked for WBZ TV, which was the NBC affiliate there, and then I ended up moving down to Atlanta and working at CNN as a news writer and a news producer. And it was exciting at first, but I really got burnt out by it very quickly. It was like it's kind of the different stories, but the same story over and over again. And I just found the people in the business to be really cynical, and just dealing with the news cycle just was not satisfying to me. I always wanted to, be creative and work in the television business. So what I did at that time was, I said, all right, I need to make a change now, otherwise it's going to be too late. I'll just be a lifer here. So I
And
ended
how old
up,
were you when you made that change, if I can ask?
I made it relatively late. I was like 26 or 27 at that point.
Oh, they should have made a movie about that.
So I was like, exactly. Vince Williams. So, I knew at that time that the Cosby Show was shot in New York, and I'm from New York, and I thought, hey, if I get just a job on that show and be a driver, a production assistant there. So I applied for a job there. I just kept on calling and calling, and they finally the producer there got sick of me calling and said, all right, we got this job. It's the wardrobe driver, for the show. It pays nothing, but you can get your foot in the door. And I decided to do that, and I moved back to New York, and I got a job there, and I learned the business, followed around everybody and kind of figured out what was going on. And then I managed to use that to get a job at NBC. They had this junior executive training program. And I applied for that, and I got lucky enough that I was able to get an interview there, and they hired me. And so that's how I moved from news into entertainment. And then, you know, by getting that job at NBC, I moved to Los Angeles and, you know, started my first steps there.
Was that a calculated move to go to Los Angeles, thinking this is eventually where you're going to wind up? Did you have that vision? And if so, you know, what were the steps other than that, that you had to have, what had to make to have that vision come true?
Well, you know, that job was a junior creative executive position in Los Angeles. So I had to move. So when they hired me, you know, I moved cross country to that. And I did know that eventually, if I wanted to be in the business, I would have to move to Los Angeles, to the West Coast, because it's where the epicenter of the entertainment business is. And, you know, I wanted to work in TV and I wanted to work in film. And so I did. I moved to the West Coast. And then I ended up working as a creative exec at, you know, NBC for like a few years. And then I moved to ABC and got a job as a development executive developing situation comedies at ABC. Did that for a few years. And I just realized, you know, although I was learning a lot there and I enjoyed the job, you know, I really wanted to kind of become my own producer, independent producer. So I managed to move from ABC, and then I moved to MTV to run MTV Productions, where I really got to, you know, start producing.
And making the band, right?
Yeah. So, you know, at that time, there was no such thing as reality TV. The only reality TV was MTV had a couple of reality shows, but no networks were doing that. And then I remember I went to New York for a meeting one time, and I was trying to, you know, sit down with my colleagues there, and there was all this noise that was screaming going on. I was like, what is going on? And I looked out the window, and there was like 2,000 people in Times Square right by the offices. And the Backstreet Boys were there. They were appearing up on MTV Live, whatever. And I was like, boy, these boy bands are so big. And I was thinking, you know, I work at MTV. You know, these boy bands are huge. Like, how do these boy bands get created? And I did some research, and I found out that, you know, there's this guy in Florida named Lou Pearlman that creates these boy bands. And so I went to my boss and I said, you know what? We should do a reality show about the making of a boy band. We'll call it Making the Band. And, you know, we'll get this guy, Lou Pearlman, and we'll follow the process as we create this boy band.
Yeah.
And,
You even did it with more than just boy bands. You did like Danity Kane. Was obsessed with Danity Kane. I watched that show. Didn't even know that was your show until right before we were doing this.
Yeah. And so I created that show, and that got me producing. And the great thing about reality at that time was that because I had worked in news as a writer and a producer, I had the skill set to do reality because I could write, I could produce, I could edit. And I had the perfect skill set for that. So then I did that. And then I did this thing called WWE Tough Enough, which was about the making of a wrestler. And then at that point, I said, okay, I'm going to now create my own production company and go out there and, you know, make shows and sell shows and stuff like that. And I did that.
10 by 10.
I created 10 by 10.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the funny thing is, the reason why it's called 10 by 10 was my first office was a 10 foot by 10 foot office. Awesome. I had one little office.
Yeah, that's what I'm sitting in right now.
It literally was a 10 foot by 10 foot office. And I was in there. My assistant was in that office with me. We were like crammed in this office. And anytime I took a creative meeting or anything, I would have to do it outside of the office. Like I'd have to meet at a restaurant or breakfast or lunch because I couldn't let anybody see that I was working in this tiny office. And then, you know, luckily, because I created Making the Band and I created Tough Enough, I kind of became this guy known for doing those reality shows where there's a real prize at the end, right? You get to be a wrestler, or you get to become, you know, this band or a singer or whatever. And so Tyra Banks at that time was looking to do a show about modeling. And so my agent said, look, you have to meet Ken because he's the king of this format. And so, you know, I met with Tyra, you know, we sat down one night and we just hit it off. And then you know, we partnered up and we created the show America's Next Top Model. And next thing you know, that thing just took off like a rocket ship. You know, we've been on the air for 17 years. We went through 24 cycles of that show. We have franchises all over the world on that show. I'm going to Belgium in a few weeks to get Netherlands Next Top Model going.
Wow.
And I work on the other franchise as well. So
Will you preface it by where it's going to be, the area, the geographical area, you know, like Netherlands Top Model or Pakistan Top Model? Or
it's not it's just, you know, our international format group licenses the show to different territories.
Okay.
So, you know, when we first started out, we had something like 40 franchises. It was crazy. There were like 40 territories that were doing it. And our show aired in every country in the world, basically. And, you know, so we still have franchises around the world that are really doing really well, from Britain's Next Top Model, Australia, Indonesia's Next Top Model, Netherlands, we're trying to get Philippines up and running again, Middle East Top Model. So, you know, I kind of oversee and consult on those franchises as well. So that show really just...
You're retired, right?
I'm sorry?
Are you retired?
Am I retired?
Did you tell me the other day that you've retired?
Well, I haven't retired. I mean, I still have projects that I like doing, but I am in that phase.
Yeah, you're like Janet, right? Yeah,
I am in that phase of my career now where I just only do the things I want to do or I'm interested in doing, which is great. But that show really opened up a lot of, you know, avenues for me. And then I just started producing a lot of other reality shows at that time.
Yeah.
You know, I did these music shows. I did the next Pussycat Dolls. I did, you know, Miss Rap Supreme. I did a whole bunch of these shows. And had a really, really great run, you know, producing TV, you know, and then after a while of doing reality, it's like, you want to continue to challenge yourself, right? You know, you want to keep creatively fresh. And, you know, I said, you know, I'd really like to do some scripted. I'd like to produce some movies. And that's what ended up leading me to Invincible. Because
2002.
I was home one night and I was just researching and just, you know, kind of just looking at the internet and stuff. And I happened to come across this thing called Under the Helmet, which was this like little piece, like, I don't know if ESPN was running it or something, but they had it on the internet. And there was these little pieces, these stories about different sports or football players or whatever it was. And they happened to have this piece on Vince. And I watched this piece. It was like a 3-minute, 4-minute piece. And I was like, this is amazing. And I saw the footage of Vince from the 70s and him, you know, running and all this kind of stuff. And how he's this 30-year-old bartender who was trying out for the Eagles. And Dick Vermeil was having open trials. I was like, this is the most insane story I've ever heard.
Like, this guy's nuts.
It's nuts. It was like, it was crazy. I was like, this is like a made up story. This cannot be true. And I watched the piece and I immediately said, oh my God, this is a movie. This is a movie. This is like going to be a big movie. And I looked up.
Can I back you up and tell and just give you a little insight from my side?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, this is 2002. This is all happening. And we're living in suburban Philadelphia, Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And right around the corner from us, 5 or 6 miles, is NFL Films. And there's this producer in Philadelphia that lived in Philadelphia that I was sort of like his idol. And and he came and he said, well, you know, Rocky is turning 25. And I was known, and I never said this, they said it. But I was known as a real life Rocky, and Sylvester was a fictional. And the movie's turning 25, so I think Warner Brothers had the rights to it then, and they contacted NFL Films, and NFL Films contacted me and said, we'd like to do a feature that would be on NFL, on Monday Night Football, as part of one of the segments. And Ron Jaworski, my teammate, and the late great Stuart Scott are the ones that introduced it. And then when you saw it in one of those clips, like Under the Helmet, and that's when that whole thing started. And then my God, I got the call from your, when NFL Films comes to me, and I remember the kids, Gabby, what, you were about 11 then, or in 2002? Jesus.
No, I was in second grade. So
yeah, you know, and like, Vinny and I said, yeah, this thing's going to happen. And they're like, then all of a sudden they're all part of, you know, they were all part of the production and some of the stuff that we did, and it was really cool. And there it is, you know, in 2002 is when it all started. And eventually I got to meet Sylvester Stallone, and it was the MC for his first Creed movie.
And wow, that's great.
But that's how we got involved. But, you know, one of the things is, you know, what you were saying, you know, to sort of segue into this, is, why would you even take that risk? And how did you come up with Brad Gann, you know, as the writer? And then, you know, we didn't have this. We didn't have Zoom. You know, we didn't really have the internet so much back then. And everything was done over the phone, right? Over the phone.
Yep.
Probably, I have one of those old rotary phones right here behind me. And we did it over the phone, or I mailed you every Brad every scrapbook that I had. And somehow, some way, you came up with a script. And I left it upstairs, but I was going to show that script. And there it was. I mean, how did this all happen? How did that happen?
Yeah, you know, it was like, hold on one second, guys. Let me just. I just thought, hold on a second.
You're fine.
You know, I just thought the story was an incredible story. And I said, you know, this has to be made into a movie. I mean, I think I can sell this in 2 seconds, even though I'd never produced a film or sold a film before. Mm-hmm. And I don't quite remember the sequence of it, but I remember the thing I remember right away was that I looked up your number, Vince, and you were in the phone book. Like your number was a public number. I'm like, this is Vince's number. And I called you up. And I introduced myself and I told you who I was. And I said, look,
we're full of it. I said, no, this is just somebody just playing something with me. There's no way this is happening.
So, yeah. And I called you up and I managed to get to the phone and I got really excited. And, you know, we talked and then, you know, we ended up putting another deal that I said, listen, I'll represent this story. I'll go out to Hollywood. I'll get it done. And then, you know, we came to an agreement on that. And then I got introduced to Victor Constantino, who was running Mark and Gordon's company.
Yeah, he was with Mayhem.
And yes.
He was sort of the middleman. And
yeah, he was their development executive.
Is that what he was? Yeah. I dealt with him more than I dealt with anybody. I didn't get involved with Mark and Gordon until after Disney bought the movie.
Wait, so was Mayhem Mark and Gordon's company? No, I think it was. Was it?
Yeah, Mayhem was Mark and Gordon.
Was it? Okay, yeah.
I remember Mayhem Productions.
Okay, so yeah, so I got introduced to Victor, and they were on the Disney lot. And, you know, I kind of made a deal with them. I said, hey, listen, why don't we do this together? You know, you can be an EP on the film. You know, I'll get the produced by credit on it. And Victor agreed to that. And I said, listen, we need to find a writer. And we need to find a writer who will write this on spec, which means the writer would do it for free in hopes of we sell the project, and then he gets paid for it.
Oh, wow.
I did not know it was spec. I thought you put up about $1 zillion to bring this guy.
No. I'll tell you the one regret I have about this movie. I should have written that first draft because, you know, I write, you know, and I've done well as a writer, and the story was so vivid already. I knew your story so well. I should have just taken the first draft. I know I would have killed it on that, writing that draft, but at that time I was still too novice at this. So I said, look, we'll find somebody. So Victor said, hey, I know this guy, Brad Gann. And we got Brad on board. And Brad, you know, when I told Brad the story and he met you, he was like, I'll write this story for free. This will be no problem. You know, and then he ended up writing the draft and then we went out and, you know, we had multiple studios bid on this project.
Well, that was the first draft. And then Janet was on the Olympic gymnastics committee and they were having the Olympic trials out in California, Anaheim. So we thought this would be a great opportunity to meet because, again, we never met. No Zoom, nothing. I had no idea what it looked like, you know, who you were, who Brad Gann was, other than he wrote the Oscar de la Hoya story.
Yeah.
And then we had that fateful breakfast morning at the Rose in Venice. And right. Gabby was there. Vinny was there.
Was sitting right behind me, and I was like,
yeah.
Who's sitting right behind you, Gabby?
Urkel. Yeah, whoever that actor is. And I was like, I turned around, I was like, I know him.
That's so funny.
I saw a few other people. I was like so starstruck.
Yeah, it was like the who's who, you know? And then I had a Bloody Mary or two, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm all over the place. And I remember saying, where was this? We never got this when we were talking to you on the phone.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you wrote the next script, and then I think that's when everything really started happening.
Yeah, we got a guys to come in and rewrite it. And they did a great job, and I can't remember who the writers who were the rewriters, but
Mike Rich.
I'm sorry,
I know Mike Rich was one of the guys. I don't know if he was a rewriter, but that eventually wound up in, you know, Mark and Gordon's hands,
and that rewrite was really good because they added those two characters, the two friends, the one who's supporting you and the one who was the naysayer.
One of them, Michael Kelly, who's now one of the stars in the Jack Ryan series. He's the CIA guy, and he was
exactly.
So he was my number one guy, and I just saw him. I saw him on Jack Ryan the other night again, and I texted him, and he texted me right back. It was the craziest thing in the world.
That's so great.
Yeah, so that was that guy. Yeah, and that
that elevated the script a great deal, you know.
It was true, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
They were real guys. We all hung together. We did everything together. And that one guy that, you know, that he just went south on me. I don't know why. But
yeah. It's called envy.
Yeah.
You and I talked about that, Vince. So at that time, spec scripts were the hot thing, and this was a hot project. We got multiple bids from multiple places, and then we ended up deciding to sell to Disney. And the reason we sold to Disney was because Disney had, you know, was with ESPN, and we felt there was a lot of synergy there. We knew that we would have the synergy of Disney, ESPN. It was a really perfect thing for a football film, and this was a Disney type movie. That's why we ended up going there, and so. You know, I will tell you, it's like, you know, in terms of getting films made, this is about the easiest process that you would ever have getting a film made.
That's what it's a couple of years, just like that, boom.
Yeah, it never goes like that. It's literally goes, most of the time it's like 5 years of development hell and all this blah, blah, blah. But this was like boom, 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 and we got it made.
I know Rudy really well. I'm out on the road a lot with him. I do autograph shows. And he was out there pitching his movie for 10 years until it finally hit.
Yeah.
Well, Ken, why do you think that it like went so smoothly with this one versus others?
Well, I think...
Relatable, I think.
I think a couple of reasons. One, a very commercial film.
Yeah.
You know, really great underdog story. Like, people amazing underdog story, right? True life story. Very relatable to the everyman.
Yeah.
Right. And then because Disney bought it, it was like the perfect studio for it. And then, you know, they had, you know, Charlie and Gray, right, who did sports movies.
Yep.
And it's a movie that they could do for, you know, not an incredibly huge budget. Right. It wasn't like, you know, a Star Wars movie. Right. So you had all these elements put together that made it just, oh, OK, let's just get this going. So you had the perfect storm at that time. And like I said, at that time, the spec market was really, really robust. Anybody who was writing a hot script was getting it out there, and studios were bidding on them. So we just hit the perfect, you know, perfect storm of things. And we were right at the right time at the right place, you know, with this film. And that's why it worked out really well. Yeah.
Say that you would have picked this up maybe 15 years later, 20 years later, whatever. Like, do you think that it still would have had the success that it has now, or that it had, or would have even been picked up? Or do you think that that market is a little bit oversaturated now, so it would have had a little bit of a difficult time?
Yeah, I think it's a little oversaturated now, you know, ironically because of this movie as well. You know what I mean? It's, you know, there's so many underdog stories out there now, so it gets really, really hard to sell, you know, to sell one of those. So like I said, we got it at the right time. We had really good timing on that thing. We got very lucky.
It was fun.
Yeah, about 16, 17 years. And, you know, for me, I'm in here in Philadelphia because I'm driving up to Scranton tomorrow to talk to a bunch of football players, got a PowerPoint, going to show the movie to them. And then there's going to be a big fundraiser, and we're going to do a screening of the movie, and tell about all that we've talked about. Here it is. It's still hot. And, you know, it's been great for me, but, you know, it wasn't all so great as you know, we were talking about our children and where you are, and you're there in Hollywood. We're here just in Philadelphia. It wasn't easiest experience for Gabriella and for Vinny, you know, in terms of that. And again, that envy, jealousy, resentment, insecurity, whatever it is, all coming into play. And, you know, they were buoyed and attacked. Because of me, And it's hurtful. That says, I don't want any part of this at one point. And, finally it's all smoothed over. Now it's now I laugh when they call me a legend. I'm looking around. Who's this guy behind me? You know, it's not me.
So. Yeah. Was that tough for you at that period of time, Gabby, when you were going to school?
Yeah.
Really?
When I came out, yeah, you'd be surprised, right? I was surprised. It was like, when I came out, I was in middle school. And I guess kids are very impressionable of what they hear at home, right? I don't know. And then middle school, it wasn't like super horrible. I think it was like to a point where like some people really wanted to be my friend because of it. And I was like, okay. But then when I got to high school, it got pretty hard. I'll say that. And, you know, it is what it is. I guess it comes with the territory, and it's unfortunate, of course, because, you know, you think that it's like something that's so cool. And then all of a sudden you're treated differently or looked at differently. And you're the butt of somebody's joke more often than not, or you have people that want to be in your life just to say, oh, I date Vince Papale's daughter. Oh, I'm friends with Vince Papale's daughter. It's like, I'm a showpiece.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, it is what it is. It makes you stronger. It makes you who you are. But I mean, I'd be lying if I didn't for a certain period of time, kind of hide who I was because I wanted people to like me or whatever for me. And
for you. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, you know, and it was like, I was like, I didn't have these accomplishments. Like, I'm still trying to find my path, but you know, it's just for people to knock that is tough. And I'm sure that, you know, you have kids and you're raising them in, you know, the Hollywood life and, you know, lifestyle and area. And, you know, have you seen your kids go through anything really difficult? Because you have Anissa who's older, and then you have the twins who are a little bit younger. Yeah. And, you know, you had so many, you know, you've lived so many different lives while you've had your kids. And have you seen them affected by it?
Yeah, you know, I will tell you honestly, they haven't been affected by it because like for you, like growing up in Philadelphia,
yeah,
you know, you know, that world is outside of the entertainment industry. So, you know, for that film to happen with you, it's not like there are 50 other kids who have movies and dads who are TV stars. But here it's the norm, right? Yeah. Especially where my kids go to school, like, you know, My twins go to school with Elon Musk's son, you know what I mean? And, you know, like kids go to school with like big agents' kids, or, you know, Mark Wahlberg's kid, or, you know.
That's some pretty fun play dates, right?
You know, Matt Damon's, you know, kids. Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like everybody is in the entertainment business here, especially at these private schools that they go to. So it's like, it's normal, right? Yeah. So they haven't had that, you know, reaction. I think the funny thing is, and you know, I'm sure we'll probably get into this later on, but it's like, I've actually become the cool dad now, because like the project I'm doing now is all with these social media stars who like all my teenage kids are like, know like wide and far. So it's like the fact that, you know, I'm working with some social media stars that all these teenagers are like big fans of. It's like, you know, it's like Brandon and Axie are kind of popular because of that, or they'll ask Axie about them. So that's the interesting thing that's come out of that. But yeah, no, they haven't had any, you know, major issues. I think the only thing that I just worry about them is because they live in this town and everybody has everything here. It's like, how do you make them appreciate and have good values as they're growing up? And that's the thing that I'm always working with them on.
Well, how do you do it then?
Oh, you got to keep them.
I keep them really grounded. You know, we spoil them emotionally, but we don't spoil them materialistically. You know what I mean? And, you know, we make sure that they, you know, every day we're on top of them, instilling the right values, and you have to work hard for everything that you want, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we don't, these kids are not going to be kids who, when they're 16, are getting a BMW. Like, yeah, they're going to get a junker used car, you know, and, you know, they're going to have to earn their way. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you see what Shaq had said? It was really interesting, actually, because I guess his kids wanted all of these expensive things. And this was said probably within the last year. And he's like, go get a job. He's like, this is my money. This is not our money.
Exactly.
And he literally was like, he's like, really? All right, you want to go get a job? He's like, I worked hard for this. So you're going to work hard.
Yeah, he said, I'm rich, you're not rich.
Yeah.
I remember that. I'm rich, you're not rich, which is exactly the problem.
It's iconic, but it's true.
It's true.
It is.
No?
That'd be tough for me to say. I could, they see this finger right here. They both are, both Gabby and Vinny have me so tight around this finger right here. It's scary. Yeah. This is wrong sometimes. You're just too easy, right?
Yeah. What can I say? Wait, so let's go back. Well, while you brought it up, though, that movie or project that you're doing with the influencers. So, yeah. Like, what is that like working with maybe influencers versus true trained professional actors and actresses?
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, so I'm doing this TV series that I finished shooting. We're editing right now. It's going to come out in May, in the beginning of May. It's a sci-fi comedy. And everybody who's in this series is not from the traditional acting world. They're from the influencer creator community. Mm-hmm. But all of them are actors and actresses. These are people who, like, you know, when COVID hit and the pandemic hit, there were no jobs going on. All these people were like, I'm an actor, I'm an actress, I have nothing going on. So I'm going to just start creating my own acting skits and content. I'm going to put it on YouTube. I'm going to put it on TikTok, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sure enough, these people like did that. They're real actors, trained actresses. They decided to become their own director, their own writer, their own producer, and put this stuff out there. And lo and behold, you know, this group of people have developed a huge fan base. Like, you know, one of the people in my show is a woman named Call Me Chris. She's got 50 million TikTok subscribers.
See, I don't do the TikTok. I don't know these like TikTok people, but it's like somebody will send me something and say, you know, this person's huge. And I don't know them, but I like the younger kids do. And it's insane the following that these people have.
Yeah, it's insane. So she has 50 million TikTok subscribers, which is like, you know, shorts. But then the star of my show, a guy named Stephen, he on YouTube, he does like these little 2-minute skits, 3-minute skits, you know, whatever it is. He's got like 10 million subscribers. And then this other guy, Alan, has something like 15 million subscribers. And he's like, I think the most watched, second most or most watched comedy channel on YouTube. And then these other, like all these people have these huge followings.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, this is really the future of the entertainment business. Like, the entertainment business, the traditional entertainment business, is really falling apart.
Yeah.
Like, it's all gravitating towards these creators who are creating their own fan base, their own subscribers, their own content, and they're monetizing it. And, you know, I'm telling you, these, like this Chris, Call Me Chris, or Stephen He, they have a bigger following, a more popular following than, you know, whatever, Channing Tatum or Ryan Reynolds or any of these movie stars, because they understand social media and they know how to, you know, get their content to their audience, which is like these 12-year-olds to the 28-year-olds. And they are full-fledged celebrities, whether you know, whether people like it or not. They are full, like when I walk down the street with Steven, there are kids coming up to him every 5 minutes saying, hey, can I get a picture with you? Can I get it? You know, he was here for Halloween. We went out on Halloween night with my kids. He just kept on getting stopped all the time. Oh my God, it's Steven. Like, yeah, it's crazy. And so it's been a really interesting experience shooting with them. And, you know, I think this is a big experiment that we're doing to see if the industry is moving like I think it's moving.
Is it your idea?
Well, what's the plot? It's satirical, isn't it? I mean, it's supposed to just have a lot of fun with this thing, right?
Yeah, it's a sci-fi comedy. It's called Ginormo, mm-hmm. And it's basically a spoof of like these old Japanese monster movies. So okay. It's like Godzilla, and, you know, Ultraman and Mothra and all these like. And I really wanted to do a show that would. That harkened back to that, because like everything now is CGI, you know, it's like it's all computer and blah 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 and special effects. It's like, wouldn't it be fun to do a show where you actually saw like the spaceships on strings, you know, or you saw people in really bad rubber outfits, costumes, and these crazy things. And you know, you had to do what's called practical effects, where it's like, you know, there's no CG, there's no blah blah blah. And I thought it would be fun. So I came up with this show called Ginormo. It's about these team of secret agents fighting this evil organization that's putting out monsters every week. And we pretend the show is from 1972 and that the show was so poorly done so badly done on such a bad little budget that it got canceled before it even aired. So like they didn't even air these episodes. And we found this box of episodes. We found 6 episodes of this show, and we're showing it to you for the first time.
Oh, isn't that great?
Oh, that's awesome.
And that's the premise of the show. It's really funny. It's like the dumbest show you'll ever see, but it's really, really funny. It's really cute. It's perfect for, you know, the demo that we're going for, which is the demo of the social media stars. It's perfect for TikTok because we can cut them into little tiny clips. Every episode is like 10 to 12 minutes long, right?
It's perfect.
And so like, we're just really excited about it, and we're going to see what happens. And it was just, you know, it was fun working with these social media stars. And it was just so funny because I would like, we had to shoot this thing really fast because we had no budget and or very little limited budget. So I shot all 6 of these episodes in like 8 days.
Oh,
you know, in traditional TV, you're shooting one episode, 1 half-hour episode in 7 days.
Oh yeah.
I shot 6 episodes in 8 days. And I was shooting like 15 pages a day. In traditional TV, when you're shooting a series, you're shooting a movie, you're like, you know, Vince, you saw, like on the movie, you're shooting three and a half, four pages a day.
Yeah.
I was shooting 15 pages a day. And I was like going crazy, like trying to get all the shooting done.
Yeah.
And in the middle of the day, these social media guys would come, social media stars would come up to me and say, hey, how come it's taking so long?
But you have no idea. Taking so long.
Right?
You're and probably so, like, them upside the head to be like, yeah, I, so long.
I was just laughing. But then I would see what they would do while we were waiting for our DP to set up the next lighting setup. You know, like one of my stars would be off like on the set shooting a TikTok. It would take her 10 minutes to shoot it. And then literally a half an hour later, she posted.
Wow.
You know, and then she would get hundreds of thousands of views like right away.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what they're used to. They're not used to like lighting setups. They're used to just taking out their phone, shooting the content, editing it on their phone, and then just releasing it.
But
it's a completely different mentality.
Do you think this is the direction of the film industry though? Because you said, you know, you think this is going where you think it's going, or that the industry or the TV, whatever, you know, is this the future, like using the influencers versus using these A-list celebrity actors?
Yeah, I think it's what it is. It's this. I think we're having what's called the democratization of talent, right? Okay, because for years and years, up until about, you know, 5-8 years ago, Hollywood was this very closed off bubble.
Yeah.
Right. And everybody wants to get inside that bubble, whether you're a writer, whether you're a director, whether you're an actor or an actress. But there were only X amount of gatekeepers that would let you in, right? You had to have a manager or an agent, you know, or somebody who knew you, or you knew the director, or you knew blah, blah, blah. And they, you would get access, right? And, you know, back then, content was very expensive to make, right? Like, you know, before the smartphones, like you had to have like, you know, a whole film setup and lighting and blah, 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 and a big budget. Like nobody could make content. But now with the advent of iPhones and smartphones and, you know, everybody can make content.
Yeah.
That whole barrier has been broken. So the whole thing has been exploded, right? Mm-hmm. And so everybody's a producer now. Everybody's a creator. Everybody's a talent. And so what happens is you're getting this flood of content that's coming. And now Hollywood cannot keep up with the content that's being created by everybody else. Right. This is content that we're doing right now. We're doing this podcast with you and Vince, and everybody has their own talk show now.
Yeah.
Right. So now you're seeing all of this. And now these people who are creating this content, they're creating their own fan base.
Mm-hmm.
So like, what is Hollywood doing? How can Hollywood compete? Right. And so the whole economic model of Hollywood has to change because, you know, they're spending, let's say, $120 million on a movie that's 2 hours long. Mm-hmm. Okay. You, Gabby, you watch that movie, you've consumed the 2 hours of content, and now you've moved on to other content, let's say by Call Me Chris, who's done her content and for nothing.
Yeah.
So the consumption of the content, it's like they don't differentiate between consuming content by somebody who's done their content for nothing and consuming content for $120 million. They just want the next content.
As long as it's interesting to them or piques their interest, and they're going to go on to it.
Exactly. So how does Hollywood survive now? They can't. They can't. So the whole system is changing as we speak. Like, you know, all those budgets are going to get slashed.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's all going to, like, and I don't, like, they're freaking out. They don't know what's happening. And so, like I said, I'm trying to get ahead of the curve by saying, this is the way to do it. Like, you've got to find these huge influencers, these huge people who have, you know, have, like, major followings, create this content with them, and then, like, you know, build an economy around that content if you can, right? So the interesting thing here for us is that when we premiere this series, I've got 9 huge social media stars with all this following. That if you add up their number of subscribers, it's 180 million subscribers across all their platforms. So we know that when they do their social media campaign, let's say a week or a few days before we launch the series, we're going to create about 500 million impressions of Ginormo.
So are they paid on, like, impressions?
Well, that's what, like, I would, you know, I mean, they're not doing this for charity, are they? I mean, there's got to be a remuneration there somehow, some way.
How do they make money?
Because what's going to happen is everybody's going to watch the show.
Yeah.
The collaboration help blows up their channels. Because, right, this show is going to air on, like, my Starz channel, Stephen He's channel, and then all of the other influencers, all the other actors and actresses are going to do reaction videos on theirs. So everybody feeds each other in terms of their subscriber base. It blows up their subscriber base. So they end up getting more subscribers, more followers, they monetize more
money.
And get more money. That's what they want.
Interesting. Wow. Wow.
So it's a whole new world. So like I said, it's a big experiment from my part, you know.
You're genius. See.
But like, we'll see. We'll see.
People could have been doing this earlier.
I think, you know, if this succeeds in the way I think it succeeds, I think it's going to have a big impact on the industry, you know. Because they're all wondering, like, how is industry going? Where are we going next? And I think, you know, a lot of Hollywood right now still is very resentful towards creators and influencers. Like, they don't regard them as real. Like, a lot of times I'll talk to agents, you know, or managers, and they'll talk about, oh yeah, we signed this social influencer, this creator, but they almost talk about it in a very condescending way.
Yeah.
Like, they don't treat them like real stars, but they know they can make money off of them.
Yeah.
But really what it is, I really believe these stars are going to be the ones that really supplant the other stars, right? Because when you think about it, it's like, you know, how did Tom Cruise get discovered, or Leonardo DiCaprio, or whatever? It's like they just managed to find a wiggle their way into the system to get their talent seen, right? Like, they, you know, these actors and actresses traditionally, they move out to LA, they live at the Oakwood Apartments in Burbank. They go around, they try to get an agent, they get the agent sends them out on auditions, and then they get seen, right? Now there's no middleman anymore. There's a direct path. It's the same amount of talent out there. If not, there's 50 million times more talent, but that talent is going directly to the audience now.
Yeah.
So they don't really need the Hollywood system.
Cut out the middleman of the Hollywood system, yeah.
They're cutting out the middleman.
Yeah.
And so now they have all the power. They don't really need the agents. They don't really need the managers. They're like, I have my own fan base. I've got millions of people here that are following me. I'm monetizing. I'm making all this money, blah, blah, blah. So that's why everybody in Hollywood right now is just shaking in their boots.
Because they realize they're like, we might lose a lot of money.
They're losing a lot of money. Everything's falling apart. Like, I think the agents
are shutting down.
Huh?
The first screening, I saw the movie in Philadelphia, right around the corner from my house here.
Yeah.
And they call the Queen Vaud section. That movie theater has shut down. And that was where I saw the first screening of Invincible. When you just went out there, you know, you're just sort of testing it before it was sweetened and everything like that. And
these movie theaters
shutting down.
Yeah, I just think the movie theater business is just gonna be destroyed. You know, because it's like everybody, all of us watch our content on our laptops, on our phones, and streaming, Netflix, and there's so much, like, nobody goes to the movie theaters anymore. It's like you go to the movie theaters when you're going to see a Marvel movie or Ant-Man or whatever, but then you just saw, like, what happened with Ant-Man. Ant-Man had a huge opening the second week. It dropped by 65%.
Yeah.
And people are just freaking out.
Well,
right?
Your directorial debut, like, you chose to do a Netflix versus a movie theater movie, right?
Yeah, mine was Hulu, you know.
Or Hulu, sorry, Hulu, yeah.
Right? So it's just everything's just changing, you know. And, you know, I, like, nobody watches the Oscars anymore, right? It's like the Oscars ratings have just plummeted. The Oscars used to be the biggest night of the year in television. Everybody used to love watching the Oscars. And again, the reason was, back then, the only content that you got was content that was created by Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You had to wait for Hollywood content. So the bubble was intact. So you got to see all these big stars who were from TV and film go up on that stage. And everybody saw all these movies, because the only way you could see this content is going to the movie theater. All of that is gone.
Yeah.
All of that is gone. So the glamour of Hollywood is disappearing as well, right? Yeah. You know, it's like 20 years ago when I was driving, like, if you were driving down the Sunset Strip 20 years ago, and all the billboards on the Sunset Strip, if your face was on that, your TV show was on there, it meant something.
You made it.
And I remember 21 years ago, I was driving down the Sunset Strip, and I just created Top Model. Mm-hmm. And I looked on the side of this hotel. It was like the Hyatt, and it was a 10 story billboard for America's Next Top Model.
It's gotta be surreal.
I was like, I made it in the business. That nobody cares about that stuff anymore. It's like, yeah, anybody can get a billboard. Anybody can get anything.
Well, I actually want to go back to that really quickly, because yeah, with America's Next Top Model, that was my favorite show when, like, growing up as a kid. And yeah, I saw that you had done an interview at one point, and you said, What I really realized in producing these shows was that the secret to making them successful wasn't just about the competition. It was about the storytelling. Yeah. And, like, people call you, like, a pioneer of unscripted TV. But I've been like, is unscripted TV really that unscripted? Like, you see The Bachelor now, and you see, like, all these shows, and it's just like, there's got to be some sort of a script behind these things.
Yeah, a lot of these unscripted shows are what they call soft scripted.
Okay.
Right? So basically, so like Real Housewives, you know.
Yeah. Like, come on, Teresa, flipping the table. It's got to be semi-scripted.
That's all soft scripted. The Kardashians, it's all soft scripted. So basically what happens is the producers kind of go in and talk to the Kardashians or the Real Housewives, and they're like, what is going on, you know, in your lives? Or what's going on with this person or that person, et cetera, et cetera. And then basically what they do is they take those stories and they say, okay, we're going to set it up this way. So, like, we're not going to write the lines for you, but we're going to say, if you're having this beef with this other person, when we start shooting, you're going to talk to that person about that beef.
Okay. Got it.
Right. And then they just shoot it.
Yeah.
And whatever comes out of that beef, then they cut it. And so they plot it out. So, like, you're going to have that confrontation with her. Like, you know, person A to person B is like, I really want to confront her about that guy sleeping with my man.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's set up the scene. You're going to confront her. Let's see what happens. She confronts her. And then we're going to do another scene later on where it's like, you need to resolve this. So if you guys want to meet at a restaurant, you guys meet at a restaurant, but we want you to make up. Like, do you want to make up with her? Yeah, I want to make up with her. Or I made a false accusation. I found out it wasn't true. Okay, let's shoot that scene. I want to see how that plays out. They go to the restaurant. They shoot the scene. She asks her about it. And then they make up, or whatever happens.
Yeah.
So that's really soft scripting a show.
Okay.
On Top Model, we never soft scripted anything. We never did anything. We set up, you know, these girls in this house. You know, we set up a challenge, a photo shoot, which would create natural tension there. Mm-hmm. And then we would have judging. So we never soft scripted stuff. But what we would do is that we would make sure that when we were shooting, you know, this thing, we would just follow what naturally was going on with the you know, between the girls, amongst the girls, and make sure that we told that story clearly when we were editing.
Got it.
Right.
Yeah.
So we really took pride in never manipulating people to say this or say that, or or create a fictitious storyline. We always reflected what was going on in the house. Now, the girls may not have been happy about the storyline that was being presented, because a lot of times, you know, they behaved badly, or they were drinking, or they were this, or they got drunk, or blah, blah. It's not flattering, but we would never manipulate it. We always make it accurate to what they were doing.
Yeah. It's funny. I'll never forget that my mom and took me and a couple friends to a filming of America's Next Top Model. And it was truly my favorite show at the time. I wanted to be on that show. And, you know, you invite us, you allowed us to be extras in it and for one of the runway shows. And I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And I was like, I want to be on the show. And I remember my mom said to you, and she was like, you know, Gabby wants to get into modeling. You know, what do you think? And I remember you were like, modeling, like, don't do it. It is so gruesome. It is so horrible and so brutal in certain respects. Like, those weren't your exact words, but it was just along the lines of don't do it. It's not for the faint of heart type of thing.
Yeah. You know, and I think especially back then, you know, the modeling world was really, really difficult. But, you know, I think one of the things that our show has done is it's completely opened up the modeling world, right? You know, back then, modeling was very like the entertainment business, a very closed world, and it wasn't diverse. It didn't, you know, accept other types of people. They had a certain look that they wanted, et cetera, right? Yeah. And a certain size. You had to be a certain height and a certain weight, right? Mm-hmm. And now everybody's a model, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to be part of the traditional modeling world. You're on Instagram. You're doing your own thing. It's the democratization of talent, right? And it's just like the entertainment. And that whole industry has been blown apart. So you see models of all different shapes, sizes, ethnicities, sexual orientations, whatever it is, that's happening right now. So it's like, you know, Gabby, if you want to keep up, you know, pursue your modeling career, you know, you're a gorgeous young lady, like, there, you could do it.
You could do it today. Oh, yeah.
You could do it right now. You could go out and, you know, be an influencer. Like, there's a ton of these women, right?
They make money.
They make money. They're influencers. They go to the fashion shows, and then they have all these followings. So then all of a sudden, Versace and Gucci and everybody's coming in. They're giving them their bags and their blah, blah, blah. And they're showing off the clothes and their Instagram shots and blah, blah, blah. And there's a ton of these people that are doing it, right?
So like the movie industry, it's just moved in a completely different direction in the film.
Absolutely. It's,
well, you wouldn't know it if you went down to Sunset Strip. Like, you know, some of the movie, oh, that's all it is. It's just one row after the other. Like, I think the best was Cocaine Bear. I can't wait to see that. I have to tell you this, though, Ken, because you got a soft spot in my heart. You were talking about 20 years ago when you go down Sunset Strip, and I had just given a speech out there when we got a chance to come and see you. And I was right there in West Hollywood on the strip. And right at, and Janet said, do you remember right there on that sign? And right behind us was this. There it was. That was that billboard that was 60 feet high. And we're sitting there having lunch. And it just blew my mind. So those days, I think they're gone. So, oh, but you know what? You had, there's that one thing in the middle. I recognize that young. So you had a chance to be a director, right? And you took that shot up there in Vancouver. I think me and Gabby.
That's right. That was a lot of fun.
Great trip that was up there. So tell us a little bit about that directing experience as we sort of wrap things up.
I kept you for far longer than we've anticipated.
I wrote that romantic comedy and it was a lot of fun. And it was my first film that I got to direct. And it was tremendous, tremendous experience. I loved every minute of it. It was so fun shooting in Vancouver. The movie came out really well. I was really happy with the result of it. And, you know, people really have enjoyed it. And it was just fun. It was an extra bonus to have you guys up there. It was so fun to have you guys come to the set and visit and be in the movie. I loved it. So, thank you for that. That was great. And then now, you know, like I said, I've written and directed this, the Ginormo series that set me up perfectly for this now. And I can't wait for it to come out and see how people react to it.
We're so excited to see it.
It's going to be
amazing. Well, you're the innovator. You're the creator. I mean, look what you've done. You know, some of the great things you've done. But you know, it's a risk taker. I mean, and that's not the only way you're going to be successful. Sometimes you got to take those risks.
Yeah, you got to be a risk taker. You know, you constantly want to challenge yourself creatively and reinvent yourself, which is what I do. And you know, swing for the fences. You know, sometimes you're going to win, sometimes you're going to lose, but you're not going to win unless you take a shot at it.
Yeah.
We all know that, right,
guys? We all know that, right, Vince?
Yeah, we do that. Well, thank you. I thank you so much. I mean, you took the risk. You know, you're the one who got it out there. I can't imagine anybody else. I had a couple people, I had a couple people in Philadelphia when this movie concept, and I'm getting all these calls from the different producers, whatever, the studios. And I go to a couple of well-known people in Philadelphia. They say, oh, this will never go anywhere. This is nothing. This is a nothing story. And then after they found out that Disney had bought the script, and then, of course, they wanted to get involved. How can we help you out? Well, you know, don't let the door hit me in the butt on the way out, kind of a thing, you know. So,
You know the old saying, Vince, everybody's got an opinion, right? Opinions are like, what?
Yep, I know. And here we are, 20 years later, still friends and excited. I think they say, you know, I'm good buddies with Wahlberg, and, you know, the kids have grown up with this, and we're all friends. That's a beautiful thing. And the
yes. I think that's the best thing that came out of this movie, that, you know, I met you and Janet and the kids, and, you know, we have been friends ever since. Like, you are like the most genuine family. I love you guys, and I always look forward to seeing you. And we had a great time when you were out here and stayed at our house, Vince, and you and Gabby and Janet and Vinny Jr. Anytime you come out here, you stay with us, man. We'll have a fun time. And the weather is cleared up.
I see.
Weather is finally cleared up.
Sunny after we left, and I get back here to Philadelphia, and it was the same as it was in L.A. there, and I just left 85 degrees in Florida. But that's all right, because we're showing Invincible tomorrow night in Scranton, Pennsylvania. So that's going to be real exciting.
Yep. All right. Have a great time. And congratulations on everything. Gabby, you look fantastic. I heard things are going really well in your personal life. So I'm not going to go there. But
damn time.
There's a lucky guy there. And I'm wishing Vinny Jr. the best with the USFL. And I really hope to see him in the NFL. So you guys are living the dream, guys. So keep it going.
Thank you, Ken. We love you, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this was amazing. Thank you. We love you.
All right. We'll see you later.
Bye.
Bye, guys.